There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world to come in, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. I want to thank you for joining me tonight, and I want to welcome this special guest.
I'm happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as the great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today dramatized with shameful conditions. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to test its death. And the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. They were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. Funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all the Georgians. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is part of our destiny. They have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will some of you that have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that honoring suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of the shadow. I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. That one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. One day, down in Alabama with its vicious racist, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of imposition and nullification. One day right now in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the place that I go back to the South with this faith. We will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children be able to sing with new meaning, my country tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims cried. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. saw that freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every citizen, every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of our children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
That, as you know, was the divinely inspired Dr. King, who spoke about the freedom of everyone, of every race, of every color. And unless freedom rings in our hearts, my friends, it will not ring anywhere. After that sober start of the evening, on a strong and powerful note for humanity, I do want to mention that tonight our guests are Mr. Kofi Hunt, a wonderful progressive leader from the St. Pete area, who's going to talk to us about the election of Rick Christman, and maybe he'll talk a little bit about the progressive conference this past Saturday called Agenda 2014. And we've also got Ms. Meredith Ackman, Vice President of NOW, the state of Florida. Gray Torino Caceres, who works for Farm Workers Association. She'll be talking about immigrant enforcement. And journalist Jerry Waxman will be talking about the recent TPP meetings going on in the Orlando area and up-and-coming new events there. And now the news. New ID rules would threaten citizens' rights, and is special to the CNN. Sensible immigration reform will strengthen American society and the economy, but it must also respect the rights of U.S. citizens and those aspiring to join them. Buried in the comprehensive immigration reform legislation before the Senate are obscure provisions that impose on Americans expansive national identification systems that tied to electronic verification schemes. Under the guise of reform, these trample fundamental rights and freedoms. Requirements in Senate Bill 744, you want to write that down, Senate Bill 744, for mandatory worker IDs and electronic verification move the right of citizens to take employment and give it back as a privilege only when proper proof is presented and the government concurs. Such systems are inimical to a free society and are costly to the economy and the treasury. If you go to avaryvoice.com, there'll be more information on that posted after today's show. Any citizen wanting to take a job would face the regulation that his or her digitized high-resolution passport or driver's license photo be collected and stored centrally in the Department of Homeland Security, Citizenship and Immigration Services database. Oh, boy, that sounds great. And now the next story. I know you'll like this. Central Florida unions say no to the TPP. This was the article that Jerry Waxman's interview will be based on. I just want to mention he harkens back the TPP reminds him of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where giant seed pods replace real people with non-human things that look like people as they slept. A very exciting story that he'll go into a little more detail. And this TEPCO update from the dangerous world of Fukushima. How do we protect our West Coast from 20 to 30 years of radioactive pollution in the Pacific? 100 million gallons of highly radioactive water are being stored in shoddy, leaking tanks located next to a melted nuclear reactor with their spent fuel rods perched precariously in the top of blown-up buildings, all sitting on top of increasingly waterlogged landfill soil made so by thousands of tons of groundwater that infiltrated the site each day and is currently blocked by an underground barrier that TEPCO has brilliantly conceived. Even if the frozen ground approach gets budgeted and underway, it'll only work for a short time. In the interim, among a host of other problems, there's roughly 400,000 tons of contaminated water in a massive tank farm on the site, with plans to build an additional 300,000 tons of capacity over the next 3 years. But the annual increase in water storage is 150,000 tons, so TEPCO is due to run out of space and has no plans for what to do next. Moreover, these tanks they're talking about are built from parts of dissembled old containers bought from defunct factories and put together with new parts. Workers from the plant told Reuters they say that steel bolts in the tanks will corrode in a few years. TEPCO has said it doesn't know how long the tanks will stand up to the elements and the chemistry, and apparently not quite sure what to do next. There's a risk to changing the flow of the groundwater in ways that TEPCO is considering, said Tatsuya Shinkawa, Nuclear Accident Response Director of the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, at a news conference last month. The water could pool dangerously underground, softening the soil and potentially toppling the reactor buildings. The east side of the reactor building, in an area close to the sea where land was filled in, appears even more vulnerable to liquefaction. At Suana Marui, a groundwater expert, principal senior researcher at the National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology, said that reclaimed land consists of clay, crushed rocks, through which water can easily pass. And because the underground wall is blocking a certain amount of groundwater, the level of groundwater has risen in the fill areas, raising the risk of liquefaction if and when another earthquake hits. TEPCO is seeing a danger that the area near the sea might become like mud, so it's pumping up groundwater. Arnold Gunderson of Fair Wind Associates says, Japanese are proposing put in a barrier to prevent water from entering the ocean. That's 2 years too late, and will be too late by the time they construct the barrier. But the barrier also causes other problems. If the water can't go anywhere into the Pacific Ocean, it's going to build up on site, which means the nuclear reactors themselves will become unstable. The water can pool underneath the nuclear buildings, and if there's an earthquake, the fact that the nuclear buildings could topple. So by solving one problem, they create another. Is it possible to avoid that scenario? The solution that Fair Winds and Associates proposed 2 years ago was to surround the plant with a trench filled with a material called zeolite. That's the volcanic ash. Volcanic ash is very good at absorbing radiation, but the solution isn't to keep the water from getting out. The solution is to keep the water from getting in. So outside the trench, they surround the plant. If they put the water level down, the clean water outside the trench would prevent further water from leaking into Daiichi's site. Okay, next story I want to mention before we get on to our first guest is, let's see here. Nuclear expert has told the BBC that he believes the current water leaks at Fukushima are much worse than the authorities are stating. He says that water is leaking out all over the site and there are no accurate figures for radiation. Meanwhile, the chairman of Japan's nuclear authority said he feared there'd be more leaks. The ongoing problems at Fukushima increased in recent days when the Tokyo Electric Power Company admitted that around 300 tons of highly radioactive water had leaked from a storage tank on the site. Okay, and plume concentrates as it gets to the west coast of America. Study has shown the Fukushima nuclear pollution becoming more and more concentrated as it approaches the U.S. West Coast. A plume crosses the ocean in nearly straight line toward North America and appears to stay together with very little dispersion. The Japan Central News Agency reported the monitored radiation pollution that was 4,000 times higher than the standard level, Whether or not these nuclear pollutants will be transported to the Pacific neighboring countries through oceanic circulation becomes increasingly a worldwide concern. The timescale of nuclear pollutants reaching the west coast of America is 3.2 years if it's estimated using the surface drifting buoys, and 3.9 years if it's estimated using nuclear pollutant particulate tracers. Sinking ground at Fukushima has caused a serious leakage of extremely contaminated water. The Asahi Shimbun has announced that tanks have distorted when the land subsided. A tank that caused serious leakage of radioactive water in the compound of the crippled Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant was transferred in its current location after causing the ground to subside where it had been previously situated. Tokyo Electric Power, operator of the plant, said on August 24th. TEPCO said the tank may have been damaged or distorted when the ground settled unevenly, which led to the leakage of about 300 tons of water highly contaminated with radioactive materials. I wonder, you know, they keep using that term, 300 tons. I wonder if that's the highest number their calculator will go to, and therefore they're not going any higher than that. They use that number an awful lot. Okay, next up, the Wall Street Journal says they're not sure where Fukushima's melted fuel cores are or in what state they're in. An expert said it's very important to think of worst-case scenario. Even greater levels of contamination may be on the way. It turns out that the aquifer that is underneath the plant, in addition to the faults that are underneath the plant, is actually the aquifer that supplies Tokyo its water. So if that aquifer gets contaminated, experts are saying this could seriously impact Tokyo's water supply. Okay, until Mr. Hunt gets here, we have a couple other stories we can mention. Many of you know that yesterday the Progressive Caucus had a conference at the in Fort Lauderdale, and in Palm Beach, and wonderful presentations were made. Agendas were hammered out based on legislation currently under consideration on the state, federal, and local level. It was a wonderful presentation. Kudos to all who were involved, from the local folks who were making arrangements for the facility to the good people who did the presentations. There'll be a film on this event in the coming weeks. Right now, we're still in the process of downloading and logging the film. Okay, also, I do want to mention that there are a few very interesting shows coming up in the near future. We've got a healthcare show coming up next week, and we have a show on human rights coming up the week after that. So make sure you tune in. And I also want to congratulate our good friends and fellow progressive broadcasters, Miss Gwendolyn Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, Mr. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, Miss Susan Nylon and her show out of Sarasota, The Nylon Report, Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Woman Media, Miss Sita Beguil and her show, Sita Media, and Mr. Rob Abston and his show called Smile, It's Only Politics. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Kofi Hunt has joined us.
Hi.
Mr. Hunt, how are you today, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Very good. Very good. So, Kofi, there's been a lot on your plate the last little while. Why don't you give us an update, sir?
Well, yeah. I recently came back from the Agenda 2014 Progressive Conference, where we talked about policy positions to focus around, to organize, and to, you know, lobby leaders on. And beyond that, I also have a lot of very important elections going on here in St. Petersburg.
Well, you promised to tell us about the candidacy of Mr. Kreisman. Why don't you tell us what's St. Pete in for?
St. Pete is in for a very important decision. Rick Reisman coming up for mayor, as well as Darden Rice for city council, Amy Foster for city council, and the re-election of Carl Nurse is very exciting for the city. It's a chance for the city to move forward in a very progressive way. All four of those people have demonstrated that they're willing to put the people first, to put the environment first, to think about the working income families in St. Petersburg, and to start building a city that we can all move forward with. Rick Kreisman in particular is someone who, when he was in Tallahassee, he fought Rick Scott tooth and nail. He entered a bill to allow us to have the right to recall the governor twice. And before that, he had 6 years on St. Petersburg City Council. So he knows the city very well. He's shown dedication to the state. He's a proven progressive, and I think him being mayor of our city will, the fourth largest city in Florida, will be incredible for all of Florida.
What are some of the crucial issues facing St. Pete in the near term?
One of the biggest issue, I would say, is the fact that St. Petersburg has a legacy that's unfortunate in the South of segregated communities. Inherently, the south side of St. Petersburg has a 20% unemployment rate. And it also, and the amount of young black men is that are not graduating from high school is over a third. And so we have a lot to do in that area of town, especially. Beyond that, a lot of St. Pete wants to have, you know, sort of what they call a seamless city. There's a very important issue also with the pier in St. Petersburg.
Uh-huh.
It's a local landmark, and there's been a pretty intense battle in the city over what we're going to do. There was a decision to have a building called the Lens built in place of the pier, and that sparked a pretty intense ballot referendum that was very contentious. And now this Tuesday, August 27th, we finally get to decide if we're going to stop the Lens, so to speak, or if we're going to go ahead with the project once and for all.
So I gather with your support of Mr. Kreisman, he has he's been a solid contributing member of the progressive community for some time then.
Yes, yes, yes. He's been part of public life since 2005, and he's been a solid contributor to public life. I mean, he was the deciding vote for a piece of land in Hernando County to make it public land so that it wouldn't be developed on. He championed like things like the Human Rights Ordinance in St. Petersburg, and he was actually the first elected official to sign the St. Petersburg Pride Proclamation. He was like implemental in getting like our St. Petersburg Library on the St. Petersburg College campus to become a community joint library, so the community could share in the resources that the college had to offer. I mean,
well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. He has a career of really, really investing in the community. I know the AFL-CIO has put their full support behind him, and that says a lot, you know, of course. And even the teachers union, even as a city council candidate, has put their full support behind him as well. So, he's the real deal in a lot of ways. But, you know, I tell a lot of progressives, it's not just about who you elect, and it's about holding them accountable. And actually, in a recent article, Rick Kreisman, when he was going around talking to small businesses, said that he wants to be held accountable when he gets elected.
Oh, my
goodness. He wants
to
lead. Yeah. Yeah, he's a real deal.
It's kind of like, I dare you.
Yeah.
It sounds like a really good attitude with this gentleman.
Yes, yes. He has a very good attitude. His campaign slogan is to listen, to learn, and to lead. And we have a strong mayor system here in St. Petersburg, so the mayor has a lot of power. And that's what we need, because the mayor that we have had, Bill Foster, he hasn't been someone that was willing to really step out and sort of guide the city. He is more of a conservative, and he has a sort of mindset of government not really being involved. And a lot of great things have happened in this city, from the People's Budget Review, a coalition of progressive groups that got together. And
I heard about that. That was fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, things like that happened. A lot of the great things with the Sierra Club bringing a net zero building to our city. The St. Pete Pride event that brings millions of dollars to our city every year. These things happen not because of our current Mayor Foster. They happen in spite of him. And once they happened and they were very popular, he joined on and was like, you know, these are really great things. We need a mayor that, while these things are being built, helps to build them brick by brick, because then they can be even stronger for everybody, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, so is the current incumbent the main opposition to Mr. Kreisman?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a very dramatic race. There was an opponent. She's still in there, of course, because the primary is this Tuesday, but last time that, when Mayor Foster was first elected, this has been his first term, where he's actually pulling that 30% for an incumbent is really bad. But in his first term, he was up against another former city council member named Kathleen Ford. And he lost in a very hotly contested race to her. She was also a Democrat in the race. Mayor Foster is, of course, a Republican. But this time around, she decided to run again. And Kathleen Ford, instead of returning to public office, decided to return to her sort of private practice as a lawyer. And one thing she took up was the peer fight. And so she's been really a lawyer for the organizations that, like the PAC organizations and whatnot, and also on her own initiative to stop the lens, so to speak. And so she had a lot of steam coming into the election because of that. But what happened was that, absent of that initiative of the peer, not dealing with the sort of public safety issues, the sort of the poverty on the south side, the other sort of environmental issues in the city, she didn't really have answers for those sorts of things. Her initial steam started to subside when the real hard questions started to get asked in debates. And Rick Kreisman, being very involved in the community, going to almost every single small business that he can, going to community forums on the south side, on the north side, on the west side, on the east side, he really appealed to voters in a grassroots way. And so he surged to be a very the last poll had him within 1 point of the mayor and had Kathleen Ford trailing far behind. So it looks like it's going to be a runoff between the mayor and Rick Kreisman going into the general election this November.
Wow, it sounds like a very exciting race.
Yes, it's very exciting.
How's your water supply issues over there? How about saltwater encroachment, that sort of thing?
I know that that's been something that our local environmentalists have definitely been working on, because we are a peninsula, of course. I know that Pinellas County used to have its own water supply, like, a long time ago, and we actually ran out, and now we have to bring water in from some of the northern counties and whatnot. I know that, the current mayor hasn't been willing to look at sort of things dealing with the environment, from, like, not really being interested in investing in sort of climate change operations to, not really leading in general. I would say that Rick Kreisman is someone who I've seen embraced by environmental activists, and I think that he'll definitely work on that issue. I know that there is important progressives, like, there's a water summit going on pretty soon. I look forward to hearing more about that. I personally am more of a economic progressive activist, but I look forward to hearing that from my my environmentalist brothers and sisters in the progressive movement about what we can all do to make the water situation in Florida a lot better, because I know that that's a huge issue for us all.
Yeah, well, frack me, Dr. Memory, huh?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you one final question. What would you say were some of the high points of that Agenda 2014 event Saturday?
I think that the high point is always meeting with progressives from all over the state, hearing that there's people who have the same concerns as you and the same passion to work as you. And one of the most exciting things was having Nan Rich there and Mark Pafford, especially Senator Rich, having her come and be greeted warmly by all the progressives in attendance. I know there's speculation on a lot of people running, and if other people decide to jump in the race for governor, she's currently the only gubernatorial candidate that's been announced, that we can have open and honest debate as Democrats and decide who we want to represent us as our nominee. But for now, this was really the first time that I've seen her really strongly embraced by such a large group of people. And I really hope that our conference and the reception we gave her helps to give her a lot of energy going forward. And I hope that our movement gets to work with her, because a lot of things she was saying resonated with everyone in the room there. And, that's the sort of person we definitely want representing us in Tallahassee.
Well, thank you so much, Kofi. Any final words you want to leave us with? How can we support the Christman campaign with you?
Rick Christman, if you could email his volunteer director, jacob@christman.com, to help set you up with a virtual phone bank. We have a pretty tightly contested primary on August 27th, and that's this Tuesday, and we use all hands on deck. Beyond that, if you want to go look up Christman for Mayor and donate to this campaign, every little bit helps. And besides that, just keep us in your thoughts. And I'd just like to say, I love being part of the progressive movement of Florida, and I think together we're really going to do exciting things in this state.
Well, thanks for all the work that you do, my friend. In fact, I'm going to play Nan Rich speech next.
Okay, excellent. I'll make sure to listen.
Okay, take care, Kofi. Thanks again.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, as Kofi was mentioning, that candidate Nan Rich for governor of Florida gave a wonderful speech Saturday at the progressive conference called Agenda 2014. Here's Miss Rich from Saturday.
Thank you. Thank you. Of course. I can just say I agree with everything you agree with. Well, thanks for including me here today. It's very exciting. I have this feeling, and it comes from now spending a year traveling the state, over 200 visits, events, fundraisers. Many of you have been part of them and have helped me organize them. But I have this tremendous feeling that there is power in the people. I read a lot about the special interests and all the money, we disagree that money is important in the campaign. But you know what? Organizing, getting the grassroots to come out and to support you, I think, is really the most important thing. And I can tell you that I feel that way because right now, my own name recognition has shifted, polling numbers are shifting, and it's not about the money. It's about traveling the state and meeting people all over the state. And the progressive movement in this state is growing by leaps and bounds. I can tell you from the end. I'm embarrassed to say, I'm progressive. They're not even embarrassed to say I'm a liberal. Even though Lenny Curry, every time that Lenny Curry, I've heard you boo at Weatherford, you should boo at Lenny Curry too. Because he's now started attacking me. And you know what? I take that. documentary that now people are realizing that I am a threat to Rick Scott and to defeating him in November 2014. Most of you, some of you probably didn't live here 14 years ago. How many people have lived here more than four? Yeah, okay, so most of you. That's good. All right, so you do have history. That's good. More than our governor has. I think he was here 7 years before he ran. Okay. Anyway, it's been 14 years since we've had a Democratic governor in the state of Florida. Just think about what has happened in 14 years. When you look at the issues that we care about that I heard as I walked in this room, but when I think about the assault on women's rights that's gone on, since Jeb Bush, Charlie Crist, and Rick Scott have been our governors, when I think about the assault on public education, I had this discussion with Maureen Dinnan, who used to be head of FDA and was a school board member in Broward just the other day at an event. And she said, you remember when you first came to the legislature in the year 2000 and I said to you that they were trying to destroy public education? And I said, no, you know, they're trying to have more choice, they're this, that. No. You know what? Now I totally 100% agree they are trying to destroy public education in the state of Florida. Affordable Care Act, $51 billion that we're returning or cannot draw down the federal government, our taxpayer dollars, to ensure another 1.2 million Floridians. The dismantling of growth management in our state in 2011, one of the worst bills that rolled us back pre-Reuben Askew. Some of you may not have been here when he was governor, but that rolled back 40 years of growth management law and environmental protection in the state of Florida. These are the issues that are so important and why we must change the direction and the leadership or the lack of leadership in the state of Florida today. There is nobody up there watching out for the social justice issues. When you think yes,
and there we go. That was Nan Rich at the Progressive Conference yesterday. I want to play this brief clip from Bill Nelson speaking on Channel 5 in Palm Beach about some of the issues regarding the outflow of that filthy sugar water from Lake Okeechobee. This is Bill Nelson on Channel 5 in Palm Beach.
Stop a lot of that nutrient-laden water coming out of Lake Okeechobee being dumped into the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee. However, there's a lot of runoff, storm water runoff from the agricultural areas.
Urban runoff.
That's going to have to be treated as well. That's what we're digging out there, a feeder canal to go in to a new 9,000-acre kind of like a settlement pond that will have all of these plants planted in it that will suck out those nutrients and cleanse the water
before you send it into the Everglades.
Before you send it either into the Everglades or east to the St. Lucie or west to the Caloosahatchee.
Senator, so many people say we've talked about Everglades restoration for a long time. You certainly have been front and center in that fight. We talked about back in 2000, a 30-year plan, an $8 billion plan. Many politicians opposed in front of the Everglades ever since. I can't remember a presidential campaign where they don't stand there and say we support restoration. And yet people still, 13 years later, say the water's still going east and west. Everglades restoration is not even close to being done until the water can be cleaned and moved south. They're going to dump it east and west. And people are saying to me, and I know they're saying to you, when will we see action? We're only at the point now where we may see Congress begin to take this up and put it in the water bill late this year. Are there really, truly any guarantees you can make that we're going to see real movement for the next 2 to 5 years on Central Everglades restoration to begin with?
We have to. We don't have any choice. Now, for example, a lot of these projects, just with regard to Everglades restoration, they're in the water bill.
Mm-hmm.
The Water Resources Development Act is for all the water projects in the entire country. We passed it. Huge bipartisan vote in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
We passed it last May. We can't get the House to act because there are so many people that are all wrapped up in the Tea Party idea of the sequester. They think the water bill is too high in the appropriations. Go talk to these people out here that are seeing the St. Lucie and the Caloosahatchee.
And Senator, you raise an excellent point. Given the stalemate in Washington between Republicans and Democrats, ongoing sequester cuts, $85 billion, and we've got to see what happens on into the next fiscal year. Is it realistic? Can you sit here as our senior senator and say, listen, if it's up to me, you'd make it happen, but can you guarantee people that a year from now, 2 years from now, three, we will see the backing and the funding for Central Everglades restoration, given the climate in Washington right now? What's your answer to the viewers out there?
The climate in Washington right now is gridlock.
So no guarantees.
Well, unless the American people, or in this case, Floridians, get in the face of these members of Congress who are insisting on the sequester, which is this idiotic idea of cutting across the board without regard to the importance of the projects. Until the American people, in this case, Central and South Floridians, will get in their members' face and say, we're going to take it out on you if you don't help us with this project.
And there we have Bill Nelson advising South Floridians, Central Floridians, to get in the face of their representatives, you know, their employees, government of the people, by the people, for the people, get in their faces and let them know they will pay a price for opposing the public interest and supporting Big Sugar. So I think we can say safely that that's some pretty darn good advice from Mr. Bill Nelson. Okay, now I'd like to bring on Ms. Meredith Ockman, who has a wonderful presentation for us. She's going to be talking about some of the issues from the now perspective. One moment, please. There we go. Ms. Meredith Ockman, Vice President of Now of Florida. I'd like to introduce Meredith Ockman, Vice President of Now of Florida. Meredith, welcome.
Thanks, Rick. It's always wonderful to be on.
It's our pleasure to have you join us. What's new?
Well, this week we are celebrating the 93rd anniversary of women having the right to vote. So I'm basically parading myself across the through the state, at least on the East Coast. Earlier this week, the first ever Treasure Coast Now chapter had up their Women's Equality Day event with the supervisors of elections from both Martin County and St. Lucie County in attendance, and it was wonderful. And then toward the end of the week, we're going to have the National Women's Political Caucus of Florida is having a bruncheon. It's to include awards to State Representative Lori Berman, to the Commissioner Gunsberger from Broward County, Representative Mark Pafford from Palm Beach County, and several others. And the award is going to the mayor of Coconut Creek, Becky Tooley, as well as awards going to the National Council of Jewish Women. So it's really exciting. And then we also, on Monday evening, we're going to have a Women's Equality Day event with the coalition partners of Palm Beach County, which is going to be huge. And that's going to be at the South County Civic Center, where we're going to be celebrating the right women having the right to vote. And it's just going to be a blowout. We're going to have singers from several TV shows that have featured contestants as singers, including I think America's Got Talent and that sort of thing. So it's going to be a really wonderful event, and I'm really looking forward to this weekend. It's going to be a lot of fun.
So for people who still want to get their tickets, haven't gotten theirs yet, where can they get their tickets?
The event on Monday night, which is at the South County Civic Center, is a free event. And it starts at 6:30. We're going to have a meet and greet with the elected officials and elected officials in particular, and probably some of the candidates who have already announced. And then we will have the main event happening in the main room.
Let me ask you to weigh in on some of the national and international events. It seems that while we've had the good fortune of having women's vote for the last 100 years, there's still a good ways to go on some other issues. And I'm thinking in terms of some of the draconian measures going on, whether they're ALEC pushed or just stupidity pushed, I don't know. Why do you think the right feels so comfortable stepping on women's access to medical care? Do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, I think that the problem is that there's been a development of complacency on the more liberal side, because the right has been very strategic in chipping away a little bit at a time at the right that women have as far as access to healthcare, and in particular at reproductive rights. And I think it's disheartening to see that, you know, when they take a little bit at a time, it seems as though it's not as much of a deal to the general population, unless you understand that for every little bit that they take, they're going to take a lot more next time. And, you know, so what we're seeing now is a result of that. And so we're looking at issues that we haven't seen since the 50s coming back at us, and we're having to deal with those issues that we really shouldn't have had. The other piece of the puzzle is that when a national law is enacted, when we have a national rule, there's ways that the states have found to go around making changes to state regulations that will almost supersede those national rules, which would include but are not limited to some of the more covert rules. For example, you know, going into a clinic that's been functioning and been operating for years, and saying that the hallways have to be accessible for a gurney, for example, and having hospital-type regulations. Well, a hospital gurney was not always what it is today, and you don't always need to be able to fit a gurney into a room where people are going to go in for counseling. So it's not a fair system the way that they're using it, but they've gotten the opportunity to do so on the state level. It's why it's so important to get more liberal-minded, more progressive people into the state legislature and into, you know, the state house seat. I mean, it's imperative.
You know, we're facing a situation where we're about to embark on the initial phases of the national healthcare process, and it seems to me to stand in stark contrast with these new restrictions on women's access, and I really want to put it in terms of family access to Planned Parenthood type resources, and in some cases that's the only healthcare some women even have access to. It strikes me so you know, wrong-headed that we're going in these two different directions at the same time. Do you think that we need to really work harder educating young people about the tenuousness of access to these medical services?
I always think education is so incredibly important. I mean, if we're not giving younger people the opportunities through education to make sure that they understand how to advocate best for themselves, then we're really doing them a disservice. But as far as the healthcare laws that are coming into effect, the thing is, there's going to be a transitional period where it might be a little uncomfortable for some people because we don't understand it as well until it's actually rolled out and completed. And I think that during that transitional phase, it's going to be of the utmost importance to make sure we're on top of that piece exactly that you said, the education and learning about what we can do with the new system that we wouldn't have been able to do with the older system. I think that the fact that this is rolling out is going to ultimately be really wonderful. I think it's going to take some people some time to realize how wonderful it was.
Regarding the military, we have seen a very modest reaction to the terrible attacks on men and women in the armed services. Do you think there are forces mobilizing to try to improve that situation? Clearly, it's gotten the attention of several senators.
I think it could not be more important to get the administration of sexual assault prevention and response out of the military. There's no way that it's logical to me that somebody who's gone through the system, watched all this happen and possibly been part of it, would be unbiased in making sure that the person who comes forward with a complaint, you know, of injustice, of horrible treatment, that person could be treated properly. So first and foremost, that absolutely needs to be the case. I think that, you know, what we've seen is on a you know, global scale, from a big picture standpoint, there have been attempts at making some changes, but there's a whole culture within the armed forces that I think really needs to be addressed, and that's going to take years to actually get to. You know, I really fear for the health and safety of the people that we have in our armed forces, for both, you know, mortal danger because of the wars that we're in, and also because of this, of the sexual assault that doesn't discriminate. And this it's mind blowing how many people are actually victims to sexual assault within the military. I can't even imagine.
You know, I think the numbers that stick in my mind were something like almost 30,000 people, and if that's mm-hmm. what's reported, it's going to be a third to a half of what's really going on, given right. the onus of it. You know, I'm always amazed when people talk about a post-feminist era or a post-racial era, when clearly the problems are still so much with us. In some senses, there's been so little progress. You know, I'm very concerned where we've got, you know, all these cutbacks and the privatization of education when so many rights seem to be dissolving before our very eyes, whether it be privacy or, you know, security in one's persons and effects. There seems to be an awful lot of challenges to our basic American assumptions, and yet we see our education being co-opted and privatized. When you talk to people at NOW, for example, on a state level or on a national level, what tactics are being considered to make sure that the next generation is going to be brought to an awareness of the necessity of fighting for our rights? You know, we are so far from women's pay equity, it's an embarrassment out of a civilization, I think. That battle still needs to continue. Human rights battles need to continue. And clearly they're not getting that in the, should we say, standard educational job-oriented approaches that these new testing mills are coming to. Is NOW planning to roll out some new programs to help get that outreach?
I mean, NOW, especially throughout Florida and throughout the country, has been sponsoring youth women's groups for quite some time. As a matter of fact, my home chapter of Palm Beach County NOW supported the FAU Women's Studies Program to make sure that it didn't actually dissolve when it was running out of money, and we made sure that it was able to stay and that it was able to move forward so that it has a good, strong group now. I think that it's incredibly important that we support younger people. As a matter of fact, we're going to be rolling out a few contests that are coming up that would include a trip to the National NOW Conference that's going to come up next year in Albuquerque. We were just talking about this at the State NOW Council meeting the other day, and we're doing our part to make sure we're on social media where younger generations are, and utilizing as much advertisements as possible. And really, when we do that sort of advertising and when we do the work that we do, the most important part of that, aside from actually achieving the goals that we set for ourselves, is to make sure that the younger generation understands what we've done, why we've done it, and why we advocate for the issues that we do. And I think that we're doing a good job of that. I've seen a lot of, you know, in the 10 years that I've been working with NOW, I've seen a lot of younger people coming in, and really, they get it. They're smarter than we were at a younger age, and they're able to really understand and communicate the issues the way that they should be. So mentoring people, as a matter of fact, through the National Women's Political Caucus that I'm Vice President of Public Policy, we do mentor programs with the elected officials, in particular women elected officials, but anybody who's willing to help us. And we make sure that the younger generation has mentors so that if they're interested in running for office, that they're able to do so. And, you know, there's we work together on a lot of different issues, but that's definitely something that we've been focusing on to make sure that women have the support so that we can move forward, because we know that men have had the support.
I know we can always count on you for good news, so I appreciate you telling us all those good works. I've got one more tough issue to raise with you, and I'm counting on you for just the typical wisdom that you always have for us.
Hope I can fill that.
Oh, no question about it. One of the things that I find, you know, troubling about our dear beloved Sunshine State is that case of the young woman up in Indian River. And some people have somehow decided that the interests of the state are served by having her incarcerated again. You know, I'm talking about Caitlin up in
mm-hmm.
Sebastian. What's your thoughts on that situation?
Well, you know, I think it's a really sad situation in general. You know, the problem is in having contact in the last several weeks. You know, I can understand why the law has said that she did break the law as far as the court system is concerned, because she did have contact when she was ordered not to. Prior to that, the only voice that we heard was a voice of Caitlin's mother saying that she's being discriminated against because she is gay. And the question was whether or not that was true. Unfortunately, the only person who was able to speak at that time, because she was not a party to the case itself, was her mother. And her primary goal in doing that, in publicizing the case, was to get Caitlin the most support so that she wouldn't go to jail and wouldn't have the kind of repercussions for what they had done. You know, I think this issue is such a sad issue, and it goes back to the fact that I believe the system, the parents, the school, all had a part in ensuring that these two girls were socialized as equals within the groups that they participated in. And I think that if they didn't want to have it be the case where people got together like that, then they really should have been more careful about ensuring that those groups weren't put together. You know, if it was a male-female situation, if it was mixed up, it wouldn't have been the case that they would have shared hotel rooms when they went off to different events they might have gone, that they wouldn't have been put in the same position. And so when you look at it from that standpoint, you really have to understand that the issue is more complex than just one issue. And it's terribly sad, and I really, you know, I would love to see a positive outcome for both of these young women. I think they're both, I think that the law is going to catch up with Caitlin, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. But, you know, I don't know, I don't want to place a judgment on the appropriateness of the relationship itself. I just think that it was really sad that it came out that way.
You know, one would hope that the severity of the justice is tempered with some compassion from time to time. And clearly, while one might argue that the letter of the law was violated in the initial relationship, clearly, you know, the levy of justice with mercy would strike me as to better serve society's longer term goals. But
I agree. And the thing is, the problem is that judges don't like when you don't listen to them. I think that's part of the issue there.
I concur with you there. Is there any other news that we should know about in terms of women's issues and human rights issues in Florida for this end of summer 2013?
Well, you know, I think it's really important that people start getting involved in the elections that are going to be coming up, both across the state, both nationally, internationally. I've been known to make calls for people that are running in other states as well. And so, you know, personally, I'm supporting several different candidates in New York. I'm hoping that Christine Quinn comes out of the election that's coming up in just a few days. You know, locally, I've been personally dedicated to making calls for Nan Rich and trying to ensure that we have support for her on a state level.
What a great candidate she
is. Yeah, and it's really important. I mean, I want people to get involved and to get started with those things. And if anyone knows of anybody who could potentially be a candidate, please get in touch with me so that I can make sure that we have support for you. We've got mentors. We just I would like to see more mentees come up so we can pair people off and make sure that we have a good, solid future.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Meredith Aukman, Vice President of Florida Now, and just a wonderful person in so many areas. Thanks so much for all that you do, Meredith.
It's always a pleasure, Rick. Thank you.
Okay, you have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Ms. Gray Tirico Ceceris, whose focus for the Farm Worker Association is on immigration enforcement.
Hello?
Hi there, is this Gray?
This is Gray, yes.
Hi Gray, this is Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network News Director. How are you?
I'm good, how are you, Rick?
Very good. Gray, the reason we're talking this morning is because, unfortunately, there are forces in our country who continue to use immigration as a bloody stick, who, whether for purely venal or for financial reasons, are attempting to criminalize everyone who is an undocumented person. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your project?
Yes, I work with the Florida Immigrant Coalition based out of Miami. The mission and vision for us is to find equality and fairness for all who live in this country, specifically immigrant communities. And currently we're really fighting to, you know, find a way to bring 11 million people out of the shadows because of the system that currently makes it so difficult for them to adjust their status, to actually be contributing citizens of this community. And we really want to find a way to make everything work for the betterment, not just of immigrant communities, but for all of us who live in this country.
You know, there are so many intelligent arguments of why we need to improve our immigration process. And the inequities are huge and terrible. The pain and the damage they inflict on people, on children, on families, is literally monstrous. Tell us about how you're working to make this a more humane process.
Sure. It brings me back to, I mean, this is not the first time that we've seen immigration laws that just really don't make sense for us, not just on a humane level, but also economically. Back in 2011, the Florida Immigrant Coalition engaged in a fight against an SB 1070 copycat law, which, if folks remember, in Arizona, actually legalized the way that police officers could engage with people who didn't provide proper documentation and actually could arrest them on site. Very similarly, Florida was going to bring that to our backyard. And, you know, we really engaged in a moral argument and also just visibly brought people to the doorstep of Governor Rick Scott and let him know that, you know, we're not just talking about immigration as an abstract type of issue. We really are talking about this in faces of the people that, one, bring food to our table. I mean, again, Florida is largely agriculturally based, and a lot of the folks that work, especially, for example, in Collier County, a lot of the folks that work in this area are migrant farm workers. And so we were able to bring that conversation to light by bringing people physically into the Capitol, bringing farm workers into the Capitol, bringing the children into the Capitol to make sure that they understood that this is not just this, you know, this monster of an abstract type of term. It's not just a statistic. So what we want to do is, very similarly now, bringing that back, is making sure that people understand that in order for all of us to have a better way of living, to be safe, we really just need to bring folks out of the shadows. It doesn't make us any safer keeping them there. We need to make sure that people contribute to our society. Many of them already pay taxes. We need to continue making sure that they're contributing in a way that helps all of us, and especially in a fledgling economy where we all need everybody to have all hands on deck. We need to make sure that folks have a way to do that. And what we're asking is not something far-fetched. We're asking for a pathway to citizenship so people can have that place in society, not creating a permanent underclass. And at the same time, we're also asking for common sense immigration laws, not those that continue profiting off of our people who are in detention for minor traffic violations, for example, and the many private prison companies that are making money off of this as well. So that's in a nutshell what we're really looking to do in the next couple of months.
You know, one of the things that troubles me is for this immigrant hate to really exist, it requires a few things. It requires an absence of any kind of human compassion. It requires an absence of any knowledge of history whatsoever. Because the immigrant problem, if you take it back to its very core on this particular continent, if the Native Americans had a more restrictive immigration policy, the only thing that Columbus would have discovered is he wasn't in India. And I come from immigrant stock. My grandparents came to this country. I grew up in an immigrant community. In the community that I grew up in Pennsylvania, there were Russians and Hungarians and Poles and Russians and Czechs and Slovaks, Italians, Irish. Everywhere in that community, there was a real present knowledge that without immigration, none of these people would be here. And if you go back to the 1880s, the big bugaboo of immigration was Chinese. Well, there were actually treaties in place, despite the way the passions of the people were stirred up, that said that anyone, documented or not, citizen or not, anyone on this country had the right to be treated within the rules and laws of this country. There was no such thing as un-citizen. You still, as a human being, had basic rights. And when you look at the disparity between the way the Haitians are treated and the Cubans are treated and the Central Americans and Mexicans are treated versus European immigrants, the inequity is towers to Everest.
No, and I agree with that, and it's not surprising. I mean, many Americans don't even know about the U.S. occupations that took place in places like the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Haiti, and the list goes on and on. And for many folks, specifically in the Haitian and Central American communities, you know, it's not surprising that the U.S. has adopted policies where they completely dismiss political, kind of turmoil, specifically because if they acknowledge it, then they would acknowledge their hand in that. And so by the same token, in contrast a little bit, there was a symbolic competition between the U.S. and the Soviet bloc during the Cold War, which gave way and it made it really, really easy for the U.S. to say, well, these folks are political refugees. Cubans have a way to actually adjust, and obviously that gave way for the Cuban Adjustment Act in 1966. So again, I mean, there's a lot of backstory to all of this that obviously precede what we're seeing in immigration law currently that, again, place us in a really different type of context. And you know, having those conversations are just as important as the conversation that we're having currently on immigration reform.
I thought the tactic to show the impact on children and family and students who were brought here without any control of their own, and now they're facing either deportation or the deportation of their parents, was a wonderful way to illustrate to at least those with ears that this is a terribly destructive process that we're engaged in. And then you've got proposals by major candidates that, well, people should self-deport. It boggles the mind. And whether people come for political reasons or economic reasons, those are the same reasons that people have always come to this country. It's senseless to say, well, these people were more politically put upon than economically put upon, or these people are only economic refugees, as if those people who fled England or France or Holland or Russia or the Middle or Eastern Europe were any less economic refugees than someone coming to pick fruit in the fields. It's monstrous. How do you counsel people to deal with the current state of affairs?
You know, I think it's again, it's impactful to talk about the root causes of migration, as well as, again, the role that in many of our countries the U.S. has played. And I'm from Chile. And, again, in Chile, we had a 17-year-long dictatorship with Pinochet that, again, also there's a lot of connections with the U.S. So for many of our countries, it becomes a very hard trauma to deal with. And when we're talking about immigration reform in this current moment, it, you know, it's interesting that, again, we're talking about the Cuban Adjustment Act and then that comparison with Haitian, quote-unquote, economic refugees and Central American, quote-unquote, economic refugees, right? And many of them fighting for their lives because currently they're in deportation proceedings, you know, and a lot of the folks that primarily are in that situation are Central Americans. You know, and so we're in this process right now that, again, a lot of the debate is driven by, you know, and there is, it's actually backed up by some ulterior motives. You know, and again, I mentioned the private prison companies specifically because they do have a lot of say in this, just as investments in other countries have a lot of say in foreign policy. You know, and I was just reading something the other day that roughly, you know, on a given year, CCA, the Corporations, Corrections Corporations of America, and GEO Group, the two biggest private prison companies, spent $45 billion a year hiring lobbyists in D.C. to make sure that immigration, any type of immigration law, actually favors them, and by that, creates a profit for them. And a profit for them means, obviously, deportation for our communities. It obviously means continued enforcement at the southern border. It means making sure that, you know, parents no longer see their children because, you know, their child could be deported or they're deported themselves. So, again, there's a lot of different things under the water that people need to be hearing and need to be seeing when we're just talking about immigration reform. It's not just this abstract monster that we're dealing with and we're seeing on Fox News or CNN. It's so much more than that.
Great. Let me ask you a question. You know, I think that focusing in on this for-profit prisons, we've seen this go bad in so many different ways. Is there any way of teasing out the information of how many, the ratio of immigration-related prisoners versus other prisoners in some of these for-profit prisons? Is there any way of teasing that information out?
Sure. I mean, there's definitely a lot of this stuff is all record to some extent. There is also Freedom of Information Act requests that are being made by organizations, and you know, and I think it's also very, very important for people themselves to also be involved in this process. A very perfect example of this was last year, SLIC was involved in making sure that we shut down the process of a detention center that was going to be built in Southwest Ranches, which was located between Fort Lauderdale and Miami. And it was very clear that the residents, again, did not even know that a detention center was going to be built. But the minute they did, they found out, a slew of different things that just was wrong with the whole project. Long story short, they were able to really make sure that they got the information, they got all that research out to the media, they lobbied and pressured against that, and they shut down the whole project. So that just basically says to me that people just really need to be doing their homework and research when we're talking about all of this and making sure that they understand there is a lot more than that, and a lot of it is obviously dollar signs.
Is Chrome Detention Center still open?
It is. It is.
I imagine it's been expanded since the heyday in the 80s.
Yeah, it definitely, and it currently has about 700 to 800 beds, and again, on any given day, it's going to be full. And for each bed, and I'm not sure exactly what the percentage, but I know in BTC, for example, it's $160 a bed per day for a person who's detained. So they're really making some profit of it. It's extremely a high margin of profit here for each person that they detain. And obviously, why would you want to, you know, if you're in their position, why would you want to lessen immigration enforcement policies when that's the thing that is driving
making money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that?
So that people understand what this is in a very personal way, let me ask you to walk me through a scenario. Okay, you've got a young couple with some children riding home from the store after a hard day's work, and they're pulled over because they were driving while Hispanic, and whether the state was Florida or somewhere else in the South or, God forbid, in Texas, and the parents are confronted. They may not have all the paperwork, whether or not they're documented emigres. When the police decide that they're going to put this couple into custody, what happens to the children?
For many children, if both parents are detained on the spot, and that happens many times, I live in Collier County, which is in Naples, and we have actually two programs, the 287G program, the Secure Communities, that does create that mechanism. And for many cases in this county, many of the children of detained, undocumented parents end up in foster homes. And the foster homes, again, are federally run sometimes. And again, so the taxpayer is footing the bill for something that the government can easily, stop doing. They can definitely take away these programs where, again, it's not effective for us to be separating families when, again, the minute that you do that, it becomes a bill that we have to foot because of the fact that these policies are not working. And obviously, on a moral and more humane issue, it's the fact that we're separating families altogether, which is, to me, is completely un-American. Again, we're talking about family values, and for many folks, that's the biggest thing. That's the pillar of their life. And here we are in the U.S. separating families, creating the system where children are shuffled from foster home to foster home, and again, we are creating that system.
I am one of those card-carrying humanists that believe there are much more things that unite humanity than divide it. But I'm constantly amazed at some of the mentality of people. I teach classes in a computer field, and I had a gentleman walk into my class one evening, first time he was there. Right out of his mouth, before he even gave me his name, he says, "I'm a teabagger." And I thought, well, that's an interesting identity to bring to bear in a brand new classroom. And I said, "Really?" I said, "That's very interesting," trying to take as neutral a posture as I could. And he said, "Well, it's those damn Mexicans that are destroying this country. If you drive around on a construction site, you'll just see those people." And then he stopped for a second. And he said, "But I'll tell you what, when I get a project, boy, I hire them. They work really hard." And I thought, how must this fellow do his thinking that he can compartmentalize this problem in two ways? On the one hand, he says he hates immigrant population, and yet on the other hand, he's prepared to profit from the abuse of these people. When you add in the fact that so many of these people who are so virulently anti-immigrant call themselves Christians, call themselves a religious people of moral values, it boggles the mind. Let me ask you a practical question. With the problems like the disparity of enforcement, like with problems like the mistreatment, again, in the criminalization process, are there organizations working at an across-the-board assessment so that we can kind of tease this big, knotty problem into its component dilemmas?
Yes, for sure. Nationally, the campaign and the different campaigns that we're all part of, both statewide and locally, they have an overarching message. And for example, one of the campaigns that we're working under is the Alliance for Citizenship, and obviously the overarching message there is making sure that there is a pathway to citizenship, that we're not creating a permanent underclass, while another also is making sure that we're talking about the flip side of the coin, making sure that if we have a pathway to citizenship, we're also not continuing to extend the many impractical and ineffective enforcement policies that we currently have. Again, the border keeps coming up as well in these conversations, and it's a testament to, again, what you just mentioned as well with this young man is analogous to exactly every single immigration policy in the U.S. That is the thinking of the U.S. government. It has been since the Native American Act, all the way up to, you know, the internment camps and the logic behind that, all the way to the Bracero program, which is in the 50s that brought over Mexican workers. It's been the exact same logic, and I'm not surprised that people continue thinking that, because, again, that's exactly what the U.S. government has done. And the whole thing with the border is, again, it's a splurge completely. We don't need to double the number of agents at the border, in the southern border in particular. We are going to become the most militarized, you know, we are going to have the most militarized border in the world next to South and North Korea. You know, and just to give people that context, just think about South Korea and the militarization zone. That's exactly what we're going to look like the minute that we pass this.
I keep waiting for them to say, well, we'll be mining that border, and that they've already been talking about drones on that border. And, you know, I just wonder where that country went that I grew up in that proclaimed, you know, bring us your wretched refuse and we'll give them a place. It just, those of us who care about humanity, those of us who care about people, need to find some handle to speak to those people who really are just not prepared to grant basic humanity to people from other countries. And I'm, you know, frankly, at this point, it's something of a loss to wonder how to speak to them in a way that helps them understand that we are all human beings.
I agree with you. And I think a lot of it is going to come down to making sure that people understand in this current debate around immigration reform, the system is not working, it's ineffective, it's impractical, and it's inhumane. And if we really want to stick to governing our country under American values, which seems to be a lot of the folks that are saying out there, you know, this is, you know, what we're doing right now is un-American, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if we really want to stick to American values of fairness and justice, we really need to be able to say that and do that and actually have a policies that show for it. And, you know, we're not going to gain that if we keep throwing individuals in jail and sticking children in foster homes. That's not going to happen. We need to be able to bring people out of the shadows, give them a chance at a life that, you know, they've already had for the longest time, you know, in the dark, but now they want to, you know, you want to see that and live that in the light. And we need to be able to do that, like you said, on the moral issue. And if people really don't want to even stick to that, at least economically, it just makes sense, you know.
I completely understand where you're coming from on that, but it seems to me, you know, when we are forced to take it to an economic argument, that we've ceded the moral ground, and yet I know that this is the way some people think, and that's the only way they can understand it. Let me ask you what I think is probably a difficult question. You know, on the one hand, you're helping people, you're counseling people on how to deal with it, how to live with the current situation, how to make the best of it, how to be prepared should the worst happen. I'm sure that it must cross your mind from time to time that when you go to speak to an audience, that your very presence, should we say, alerts certain authorities that there may be undocumented people in the audience, and it might bring attention. How do you deal with that that dilemma?
You know, I think for many people, it's those specific interactions that also change their hearts and minds, and I think it's really tough to kind of deal with the, I guess, your hatred in physical form, or I guess your ignorance in physical form, and that, you know, in that presence of a person who's been undocumented who's sharing their story in front of you, it's really hard for people to take and swallow. But sometimes it's the best way for people to understand.
I hear.
And many times, in many events that we've done, people have actually, you know, even in the press, in the presence of a press, they've actually come out and said, "I'm undocumented." And, you know, and again, even, you know, combating their fear is very hard, but they do it knowing that at the very minimum, they've been able to at least acknowledge their own humanity in saying that, which is really hard. Again, you're acknowledging to people who, you know, an audience, like you said, who may be just completely hateful, but in doing that, it also is very cathartic, and it's also very needed to making sure that the debate around all of this is changed and we're actually talking about this from a human standpoint.
Well, Gray, I can't thank you enough for the work that you're doing. You stand at the borders of morality and despotism, your work is invaluable to humanity. For people who want to support your efforts, for people who want to help any way they could, can you tell them how they can get in touch with you or get in touch with your organization so that they can contribute in some small way to the work that you're doing?
Of course. And let me just say as well, the work that I do is in the presence and in the hands of so many others who, again, I have the privilege of being a U.S. citizen, but many folks who are doing this work are themselves undocumented. So just want to say that it's definitely, I'm inspired by them to do this work. And people who do want to, join the forces can do so by, visiting our website at www.floridaimmigrant.org. Again, we are based in Miami, but we're all over the state, and there's a lot of different things happening in the next 2 months, so now is the right time for people to get involved.
Well, great. Thank you so very much, and we'd love to have you back again soon, okay?
Of course. Thank you so much, Rick.
Okay. You have a good day, and the best of luck.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Now, that was Miss Gray Tirico Ciceros of the Farm Worker Association. And now I've got something a little different. I'm going to bring you a progressive journalist, Mr. Jerry Waxman, who's going to give us an update on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. If you don't know about it, you need to be informed, despite the fact that they would prefer you don't know anything. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Jerry Waxman, a journalist, activist. Jerry, how you doing?
I'm just doing fine. How are you, Rick?
Very good, sir. Very good. I understand that you had the good fortune to be able to attend the TPP meeting the other day in Orlando. Why don't you give us an idea of what happened?
It's an update on what actions are happening. Jim Howe has taken this upon himself to activate people against the TPP. And we had a pretty good meeting. We had representatives from the Sierra Club there. They joined in. Communication Workers of America, behind this, the Central Florida Labor Council has unanimously adopted this as a cause. And the Orlando Light Brigade was there as well, which means that they're going to join the action. They're going to do an action on Tuesday night at Lake Eola, which is this big park in the middle of Orlando.
Jerry, for those people who don't know what TPP is, can you sketch out just roughly what this TPP stands for?
TPP is the initials for the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. It's, at the moment, I think 11 Pacific Rim countries that are going to get together and create another free trade zone such as NAFTA and CAFTA.
Now, from the reports, we hear that everyone's describing this as NAFTA on steroids.
That's putting it mildly. That's NAFTA on growth hormones.
Plus GM DNA, right?
Jurassic Park. This thing is huge. We're talking about 11 Pacific Rim countries, including a few in South America, and Japan, Korea, the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, They're all ganging up on China. However, I don't think China's a real victim. I think we're the real victim.
From what we understand, it has an impact on labor, it has an impact on jobs, it has an impact on sovereignty. Could you flesh that out a little bit?
That's true, and I'll tell you why. Even with NAFTA, when NAFTA was signed by Bill Clinton in 1994, basically we give up our rights to sue any of the NAFTA partnerships, and if we take them to court over something, they have the right to sue us, and they collect. They have collected hundreds of millions of dollars from American cities, states, counties, for daring to play with their property. Our courts have no standing with these trade agreements. They have their own courts, and they try us.
It's a panel of businessmen, too, isn't it?
That's correct.
So it's kind of by the corporations and for the corporations.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is rollerball coming to the 21st century.
You're regularly published in a variety of publications. Why don't you tell people where they can find your writing?
Well, they can go to my personal blog, which is called, it's just producer1.wordpress.com. I am an opinion columnist for the West Orlando News Online. Have been for over 2 years.
Uh-huh.
I'm a regular contributor to the Daily Cause. I'm a regular contributor to Tom Hartman and to Fire Dog Lake. And my posts have been featured there many times. And I'm also on the Huffington Post. I've been with them for almost 5 years.
You know, Jer, one of the questions I ask my guests typically is, you know, it's hard enough to make a living, it's hard enough to raise a family, have friends and all that, but it takes a special kind of person to, in addition to all that, also try to make an effort to make this a better world. If you could reflect on your own life for just a minute, what was it that made you an activist more than just a one more person doing business? What was it that sparked your interest in contributing to the larger world?
Well, first of all, back in the day, I'm now going to be 72 years old. So I actually was able to vote in the 1964 elections, and I was a Goldwater Republican.
Wow. He wouldn't be recognized as a Republican anymore, would he?
No, not at all. He didn't really care too much about social issues. He cared about governing. And when I married into a family where they were very heavily into Democratic politics. And slowly but surely, I came around to that way of thinking. I was a businessman, and I realized, you know, even though I'm a businessman and I love to make a profit, people still have to live. So that was one of my first indications. And I guess by 1972, I was solidly a Democrat. Conservative, but the older I got, the more I saw the opportunities that my children didn't have that I had. I said, something's wrong here. And with the 1980 elections and what has happened in this country, cause of trickle-down economics, the social strata, I just realized I got to do something about it. My grandchildren, who are now 5 and 6, deserve much better and are growing up in a world totally different than you and I grew up in. And we've got to do something about that. So that's when I got involved. I got involved as of the 2008 elections. I was a captain for the Obama team in Orlando, and I never stopped. I joined the Huffington Post because they asked people to report any negative stuff that was coming down, and I used to get it all the time, and they liked my writing, so they said, well, you know, you want to join us as a blogger, you're welcome, and that's how it started.
I understand that you've known Mr. Grayson for some time.
I met Alan Grayson in 2008, and we have a very friendly relationship. We've had dinner together. We've been at social events together. I've interviewed him several times.
He's taken a very active stance on this TPP, hasn't he?
Yep, at our urging, by the way. We talked to him about it, and he was aware of it. I mean, Alan, very sharp guy. You know, he's been named as the most effective member of Congress. He has managed to get many amendments passed from both sides of the aisle. He's put together groups and coalitions of people you couldn't believe to get legislation passed. He's a whole different Alan Grayson than he was in his first term. And he was able to see these documents back in June. You know, he even said to me, I can't tell you what's in them.
He wasn't allowed to copy them. He wasn't allowed to take any notes. He could go in and view them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
It seems an odd turn of the phrase that legislation can be in play that our Congress is not allowed to see. And as I understand it, go ahead.
Well, it happens all the time. Fast track is something they've done for many, many years. They did originally fast track NAFTA, and it did not pass in time for George Bush's term because it all started under H.W. Bush. So therefore, it had to come back again under Clinton, and Clinton resisted it until he had gotten assurances that U.S. would be protected. Well, of course, he did not get protected, and it only passed by one vote back in 1994. The things that were supposed to happen never happened, and we basically ruined Mexico's economy because of it. There are Canadian corporations, Canadian municipalities and governments that are still being sued by Big Pharma. Eli Lilly has had a multi-million-dollar suit against them because they want certain restrictions lifted, and the Canadian government won't lift them. I mean, that's just one instance.
But it seems to me, from what I understand, since we can't oppose this on the facts, on the merits, based on the fact that they're keeping all this secret from the public and from Congress, so we have to oppose it by opposing this fast track.
If we oppose the fast track, the fast track will probably pass in the House because they just have overwhelming numbers. But the place to stop it is in the Senate. If you oppose the fast track, then there's every possibility that then it has to come up before the Congress and it's got to be discussed. Every chapter, and I don't know how many chapters there are, like 18 chapters, but only four or five of them deal with actual trade. Everything else is legal.
Something so, short of the transparency we were promised, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Needless to say, I am, and too many others are so disappointed in this administration. I mean, it's difficult to even talk about it.
Well, the one thing good we know is that when you do talk about it, you'll be recorded.
You know, I don't mind that.
Well, to get back to our TPP,
yeah.
There are some meetings coming up that's going to help organize this opposition?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And not only that, but throughout the country, many of central labor councils, like in Denver, Colorado, here at Boise, but Denver is coming out against it, and Wisconsin is coming out against this, and there's several others. I don't have all the information, but it's happening.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jerry, for joining us and giving us your insight. I hope you'll come back again. And,
invite you back. I'll come.
Okay, great. Do you have any articles you're working on right now?
I am working on an expose of Rick Scott.
Well, that'll keep you busy. Well, Jerry, thanks again so much, and we look forward to hearing from you with another report. Have a good evening,
Rick,
sir.
Thanks very much for calling.
Okay,
take
bye-bye.
Care. Bye.
So that's an update on the TPP issue that's going to be facing us this fall. They'll be trying to fast-track it. And, of course, remember, the reason they're going to fast-track it is so that they don't have to discuss it. It'll just get approved, and then there'll be a little discussion, but no ability to amend. So you want to make sure that you let your congressperson, your civil servant, let them know how you want them to vote for your interests. And now this brief bit of news from Montana. Gas line spill. They're reporting 25,000 gallons on the Montana tribal land. It's July 5th. A Phillips 66 pipeline with a record of prior accidents spilled an estimated 25,000 gallons of gasoline in a remote area outside a small town on Montana Crow Indian Reservation. No public health problems were anticipated, federal officials said. This, I think, comes under the famous heading of no imminent danger. This is an important expression. You need to remember it at all times. When something happens and then no one's going to fix it, they say, no imminent danger. A representative of the Houston-based oil refinery and chemical company said that the amount of leaked gas likely was less than initially reported, so said the Houston-based oil refinery. Although no alternative figure was offered, it's just better. The initial estimate came from a report submitted by the company to the governor's National Response Center. Federal and tribal officials in the company worked Friday to determine what caused the break in the 8-inch underground pipeline. It occurred about 15 miles southwest of Lodgegrass, a town of about 430 people near the Wyoming border. Same line has seen at least 3 spills over the last 2 decades. Nothing to see here. The latest spill was not anticipated to enter any surface water supplies, and no public health problems were anticipated, the company said. It was discovered late Tuesday by operators at the company's Martsfield, Oklahoma Pipeline Control Center, who noticed a pressure drop along the line, according to federal officials and Phillips 66 company spokesman Dennis Nuss. It's uncertain how long the line had been leaking or whether any of the gasoline can be recovered. Of course, it just disappeared. We're assessing the area, Nuss said. The line has been excavated in order to be able to be repaired. The closest residence is about 2 miles from the spill site, said Curtis Kimball with the Environmental Protection Agency. He confirmed that no streams or lakes were in the immediate area, but did not know if any underground aquifers were present, Kimball said. About 60 workers contracted for Phillips 66 were involved in the response effort. The Seminole pipeline carries gasoline, diesel, and other refined petroleum products from Phillips 66 Billings refinery to Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. Has a maximum daily capacity of 46,000 barrels, equivalent to more than 1.9 million gallons. Thus said, the line was shut down within 5 minutes of the pressure drop. It was not reported to the Federal Response Center until Wednesday morning, after company workers reached the site and confirmed the spill. Gasoline is highly toxic, but unlike oil, it can evaporate. It could, making the cleanup on the reservation potentially more straightforward, as long as no water bodies were tainted by the fuel. This is not saying it won't have an effect on the environment, but it's not like oil, you know, which seeps into the ground and sticks around. I mean, it said Damon Hill, a spokesman for U.S. Department of Transportation Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Now, you want to write that down. The Department of Transportation's Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. Another one of the numbers you probably want to remember is the Control and Command Center in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, the pipeline control center down there in Bartlesville. Damon Hill, spokesman for the Department of Transportation's Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety. Hopefully they haven't seen the sequester around there. The same pipeline broke twice in a week in 1977, spilling a combined 2,300 barrels of gasoline near the Lodgegrass and Banner, Wyoming. A spill near Lodgegrass was estimated at 1,612 barrels of gasoline, while 704 barrels of gasoline spilled near the Wyoming community. Conoco Pipeline Company reached a $465,000 settlement with federal prosecutors over the Clean Water Act violations related to those spills, and another pipeline break near Conrad, Montana in 2001 that spilled 30 barrels of crude oil. The latest incident near Lodgegrass comes almost 2 years to the day after a major crude oil spill into Montana's Yellowstone River. That 63,000-gallon spill from the ExxonMobil line cost the company more than $135 million in cleanup and repair costs. Nuss said it was too early to come up with a cost estimate for the Seminole spill, and it's unclear whether the pipeline could resume operations. Obviously, we want to make sure the line's safe and there's no further problems. And that's from Helena, Montana. And now, this reminder that the more things change, the more they stay the same. This from the hit parade of 1917.
Soldiers to the war have gone, who may never
return again.
10 million mothers' hearts must break for the world who died in vain.
Heads bowed down in sorrow
in the lonely year. I heard a mother murmur through her tears. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
And joy, who dared to place a musket on his shoulders, to shoot some of the mother's darling boys. Let nations of a race their future troubles, it's time to lay the thorn and run away.
But if you think we've had enough war, and you don't want to see more American troops overseas in the deserts of the Middle East, you need to let your representatives know you didn't raise your boy to be a soldier.
What victory can cheer a mother's heart when she looks at her blighted home? What victory can bring her back all she cares to call her own? Let each mother answer in the years to be, remember that my boy belongs to me. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
And joy, who dared to place a musket on his shoulder, to shoot some other mother's darling boy. Let nations of a great their future troubles, it's time to lay the sword and turn away.
There'd be no war today if mothers all would say,
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
And joy, who dares to place a musket on his shoulder, to shoot some other mother's darling boy.
today if mothers all would say,
I didn't raise my boys to be a soldier.
So if you didn't raise your boy to be a soldier or your girl, let them know that you say no war in Syria. Well, friends, thanks a lot for joining me. We're going to go out on a light note because we had such a serious topic tonight. So thanks. This is News Director Rick Spezak. Thank you for joining us. And I want to leave you with this thought. Can't let them destroy the air. We can't let them destroy the water. We can't let them destroy the spoon. We can't let them destroy the food. We have to work together. Build a better. As Willy Wonka used to say, so shines a good deed in a weary world.
Mr. Wonka?
So shines a good deed in a weary world.
Good night. Talk to you next week.